Hello and hi, welcome back to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is director Marty Langford, who has produced a rather charming and revealing documentary called Doomed, the untold story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four. And the documentary is very enlightening because I knew some of the story. I didn't know all of the games that went on behind the scenes there. So welcome, Marty.
Hi, thanks. Welcome very much. Thanks.
So how did this story catch your interest and say, you know, I need to make a movie about this?
Yeah, you know, a couple of fronts. I mean, I've always been a comic guy and a movie geek. My good friend, who I worked at a comic book store with back in the 80s, in the early 90s, moved to L.A. to become a casting director. But to get started, he ended up working for Roger Corman in the early 90s. And Mark Sykes, he's the executive producer of Doomed, was Roger's receptionist and casting assistant at the time. So he was there, like, you know, during the whole development of this movie. So I got information from him, but, you know, there was no internet. It wasn't this constant feed of information. And, you know, as soon as, like, the articles started coming out, the Film Threat article, Comic Scene started covering it, you know, I became like, you know, I can't wait to see this movie. And like everybody else, just kind of disappeared. I was just waiting, really, for somebody to tell me what happened. Mark didn't know. Nobody there knew. Nobody knew, like, the whole story. They just knew snippets. And nobody ever got around to writing a book or making a documentary. So Mark and I decided at some point, you know, maybe we're the guys to do it.
Well, you were there on the front lines pretty much, and you had Mark's connections with everyone who was involved with the movie to track them down and get their stories. And I had no idea about the guerrilla marketing after the fact by the cast members going to conventions on their own dime to sort of, you know, grassroots drum up interest in the film. That I had no idea about any of that.
Yeah, that was all Alex Hyde White, who played Reed Richards, and Michael Bailey Smith, who played Ben Grimm. Yeah, I mean, the movie was in post-production, and this was in 93, mid-late 93, and it just, you know, support stopped. They stopped doing looks at the new edits. They stopped supporting the film, really. And Alex saw this as an opportunity for him and his career, and he was not going to let it just languish. So he took it upon himself. Yeah, and he just traveled the country. He would get the other actors when he could. He'd set up at shows. He'd show the trailer. He'd get a bunch of stills and would sign, you know. He brought, you know, maybe he brought a little too much attention to the fact that this movie was, you know, out there and possibly working towards a release. And he was moving too quickly, you know, for Constantine Films, the production, the distribution company that had the rights. And for Marvel, and they put the kibosh on him pretty quick.
That was just so sudden, it seems like, from the time that they heard about it to the time that they sent out the sicked the lawyers on them, so to
yeah,
speak.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, because, the whole question was, like, how, like, the question I wanted to answer when I was making the movie, the documentary, was like, was who knew what when? You know what I mean? Like, was Roger Corman in on it? Was this a Marvel deal? Was it Constantine Films? Was it 20th Century Fox? Because they all had an investment in the project, either a literal investment in terms of money, like Constantine and Roger, or like Marvel. You know, they wanted their property back. They didn't want, it turns out, Constantine to even make this movie. They wanted the option to run out. 20th Century Fox was like waiting in the wings. You know, they were ready to hop on and make a big budget version of this. So they all had motive, you know, to shut it down. And I was just curious, like, you know, when did this start? Did they like lie to everybody up front? Was Corman, you know, a bad guy? Was it Marvel being the big corporate machine? And I mean, we got answers. We kind of know, you know, the story. But, oh, man, there was just so many shenanigans going on. It was just, you know, Jay starts the movie off by just talking about how it's this, you know, the dark story of Hollywood, you know, how these backdoor dealings go on. And, you know, even on this low level, this little million-dollar picture, it was happening. So, yeah, it can be an ugly place.
It just seems so far-fetched because it sounds like Constantine could have just shut down production once they had done enough to hold on to the rights, because it sounded like they were just trying to hold on to the rights long enough to get a piece of whatever deal Marvel and Fox had worked out. I think it would have been, you know, better for everybody's psyche if Marvel and Fox had just paid Constantine to go away. I hear that happens a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know how, like, you know, how ironclad this option was, or if Constantine recognized that, you know, Batman just came out a few years ago, made, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, global success. You know, we have the rights to make this Fantastic Four movie. They paid peanuts for it years before. And if they, you know, started production and maintained the option, then they could, for the rest, you know, in perpetuity, make Fantastic Four movies. And that's what they've been doing. That's the great, not the great thing, but the ironic thing is that this whole ploy, like, worked. You know, Constantine Films, if you watch the last three Fantastic Four movies, the big budget Fox movies, they say Constantine Films production right at the beginning. They maintain those rights based on this little scam they pulled, you know, almost 25 years ago, and left a lot of people, you know, hanging, and really, really, really hurt a lot of people in a lot of different ways.
Well, I for one wish that some of the people from the other side of the fence had responded to your inquiries to talk on camera about what happened. But the more I think about how the game was played, just listening to the actors, listening to the director, Oli
Sassone, yes.
Yeah, and it just sounds like nobody wants to outright say when they knew this whole production was a sham, because it would make them look like really, really bad players.
Yeah, I mean, we gave them every opportunity in terms of contacting Marvel, in terms of contacting Constantine Films, just barraging them with emails and phone calls and social media, and got nothing in response. And, I mean, watching the movie, if you watch the documentary, their absence and their silence kind of speaks more loudly than if they'd have just sent me a press release or, you know, a letter or had a representative give me some story that I would have put in there. Because they didn't, you know, people just are left to speculate, well, you know, maybe they were really the villain here. And even Stan Lee, by not agreeing to talk to us, left himself open to people thinking that he was kind of a, you know, a bad guy when it came to this movie and how he treated it and how he treated the cast. I would have loved to talk to Stan, but yeah, even he declined it. But, you know, at least he declined it. He responded to our requests, whereas Constantine, whereas Marvel, whereas 20th Century Fox, they just kind of ignored us, and that was kind of cheesed us off.
And even in this day and age, if you just fess up and say, yeah, I made it for business decisions, it wasn't personal, most people will just go, yeah, figured as much, and just go on with it. It's not like anybody in the executive levels of filmmaking and entertainment are angels or saints. You know, sometimes you make decisions that break people's hearts. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the fan rage on the internet that we have. But if you're honest about it, most people are willing to give you a pass. Just say, yeah, this is what I did. This is why I did it. I look back and now and probably could have handled it better, but it was a business decision, pure and simple. And people will grumble for about, you know, 3 days and then forget about it and move on to something else.
Right. Well, that's why I think Roger Corman comes off pretty well in our doc, because, you know, he tells, you know, his side of the story, and he makes it very clear that, hey, you know, Oli was telling the story, you know, that I just got a phone call from Roger, and he said, Oli, I want to thank you very much. I just got a check for $1 million, and their movie won't be coming out. And that's, you know, that's what Roger contends. And he's a businessman, and he was in the best interest of his company, of his shareholders, of his of his enterprises, and you know, that's what he said, and that's how it was. But the, you know, with Constantine and Marvel and Fox, they don't look good. You know, part of it too was that they probably, and we were just a tiny little movie. You know, they probably get requests like, maybe not like this, but from, you know, quote unquote documentary filmmakers that they, you know, that they just put in the junk pile or put in the trash that they don't even respond to. So, you know, they probably just didn't think anything would come of it, maybe, but we got lucky. You know, we've been doing pretty well in terms of, you know, our profile and public relations. And, hopefully they've heard about us now, that's for sure. And, and I guess they still haven't responded, but we'd love to hear something from them, you know, even at this late point.
So, are there any plans to have the documentary come out on DVD eventually?
Yes, yeah, we're on video on demand right now, so you can, you know, you can get it on iTunes and all the cable and satellite, you know, Comcast, Spectrum, Charter, Time Warner, DirecTV, all the and then like Vudu. So on video on demand, you can get it anywhere. And then on December 20th, we've got a DVD and a Blu-ray special editions coming out with, you know, tons of extra features and clips and, you know, exclusive content that you won't find anywhere else. And that'll be on Amazon. So, yeah, the physical discs will be out at the end of the year, you know, just in time for Christmas.
And that's what I was curious about. What kind of extras are going to be on the discs? Because I love extras. I love commentary. I love all that stuff.
Yeah, all of it. We had about a year ago, we had a screening in the Arrow Theater in Los Angeles. And the entire cast was there. Oh, I mean, everybody. It was amazing. The stage was left to right. There was like a 12 chairs set up. And they did a question and answer panel that we have on tape that's on both the Blu-ray and the DVD. And that's like half an hour long. And it's just this great discussion. We visited the locations, you know, of the original film, the old Corman stages and studios that we have on there. And more, you know, just little snippets that that didn't quite make the final cut, little stories. Jay, you know, and Joseph goofing around, wearing their old costume. Well, not their old costumes, but Joseph wearing the old mask and doing speeches from the movie and things like that. There's an interview that I had done for a television show that turned out really nice, with me talking about stuff and. Gosh, what else? We filled up both discs, you know. We filled up, 50 gigabytes on the Blu-ray and, 10 gigabytes, I think, on the DVD. So they're jam-packed.
Nice. Now, I do have a question. In the movie, in the documentary, it was mentioned that the old Corman stage was a condemned building. How is that building still standing for you guys to go visit it again?
It's funny. It's not
really.
There's actually no. It's gone. They raised it. God knows how long ago. So we go to where Mark remembered that it was, and there's some boring looking, you know, boxy apartment building there or something now. And he just tells a little story. But yeah, no, that place. I'm sure shortly after they made the movies back in probably this movie was when they tore it down, because by all accounts. The place was, you know, rat infested, gang warfare center, death trap.
Okay, I was worried about that. I'm like, how does a condemned building still be around after 20 years?
Yeah.
Now, one other question. Have you been able to view or obtain any high quality versions of the actual movie?
More so than most people, I'll say. And the clips that we use in the movie were sourced from pretty good quality tape that was laid off way back when. There's two existing copies of a 3/4 inch U-matic master spread over two tapes, one of which got destroyed in Katrina that Oli Sassone had. And then the other one, which one of the other cast members let us borrow for this. So I made a master. You know, we have a digital copy, a digital file of it. It's a 768 gigabyte uncompressed QuickTime movie that I made, which is okay. You know, it's still not great. It's not color graded. It's rough, you know, because it was just taped off of a, you know, like an old, you know, flatbed like they do telecinies.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's nothing like the quality that, you know, this movie should get, you know, in a proper release that's really been cleaned up. I mean, I up-resed it to high def, but that's just by bringing it into my Avid and, you know, grabbing the corner and stretching it out to 1080. So it's not a proper, you know, restoration or anything.
Now, do you think the originals that were, shall we say, spirited away by Marvel still exist?
I do. I mean, Avi Arad, who was running Marvel, has kind of infamously said that he burned the negative. And he didn't. That would be insane. I mean, I can't imagine they did. It's got to be there. I mean, in the hope, you know, we started trying, I guess we're starting to continue to try a little hashtag of release Corman FF to get out there, just to show that, you know, once Constantine, once Marvel gets that, I think they could make some money by releasing this film, right? Then
yeah.
they would do so. It wouldn't cost that much. And maybe if we're successful enough with a documentary about it, they're going to recognize that, oh, okay, they're doing really well, and, you know, maybe this could make us some money too. So we're hoping it happens, but we haven't heard a damn thing yet.
I think all it will take is for one person somewhere to go say, you know, we can make a pretty good return on this. Let's do it.
Right. Get some, like, low-level production guy, you know, tell him, hey, okay, go clean this up, take it out, see what you can do with it, you know, and put out a double disc of... you know, they can license our movie. Hell, I'd be happy to work with them.
And the thing is, Disney already makes how much money from those direct-to-video versions, the story versions of their big movies? They put like $5 into those, and they sell how many copies for parents getting them for their kids?
Yeah, exactly. I've got them all, you know, Jungle Book 3 and, you know, yeah, exactly. People will buy this.
Yeah. Anyway, well, thank you very much for your time today. We'll have links to where people can find Doomed online.
Oh, gosh, awesome. Yeah, thank you so much. This was great. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
And where can people find you online?
Marty Langford on Facebook. Go like me. Doomed FF on Twitter and Facebook. Doomed the Movie is our website where we've got some stuff for sale, some Fantastic Four posters, some of which are signed, and some other cool things. Actually, I recorded an audio commentary track with Oli of the original movie that we have as a download for a couple bucks. So
nice.
Go buy that. Yeah.
Well, thank you again for your time today, Marty.
Thanks so much.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
You're home from the comic book store with your favorite titles. Wouldn't they read better while listening to Krypton Radio?
Hey folks, this is Bruce Campbell, and this is my podcast. Thank you very much.
Hey, welcome back to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Noah Richman.
And I'm Darren Gulsbeck.
And we're here to have a extra chat, a bonus discussion about Doomed, the untold story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four, or something like that. Now, the documentary is interesting. It's fascinating. It's a good background look at... a movie as they say in the documentary, a movie that was made but never intended to be seen. And the machinations and intrigue that were behind that is what's most interesting to me.
Actually, you know, maybe because of the familiarity with the history of this, I was hoping for a little more kind of, I guess, juicy gossip in the vein of exposing maybe Stan Lee for something that I suspect he may be like, but don't know for sure, because he's still a businessman and he's protecting the interests of his characters. And so it was interesting to see how they kind of talked about how he was there on set, but kind of like smiling. And then behind the whole time, he's got a whole different agenda. So
yeah,
I was kind of hoping to see more of that, but you know, again, it was already basically explaining what I already knew. So, but
yeah, you know, I just finished listening to a really fascinating audiobook. It's called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. Author by the name of Sean Howe. And he mentions a little bit about this incident in the book. He talks about the fact that Avi Arad was really at the time this came out. This is when Avi Arad was really making his strong pitches to the major studios. And he was very concerned that this was going to damage the brand. So he didn't want this. He didn't want to just bury this as in, like, you know, kind of make it go away and maybe resurface in another 20 years. He actually wanted to have every copy of this destroyed so that there's no way anybody could ever see it.
Yeah, that guy, Sean Howe, he was actually in the documentary. I remember reading seeing his name in the mention of that book. Was the book very informative?
It's a very informative book about the history of Marvel Comics. It doesn't spend a whole lot of time talking about this particular issue. But it's absolutely fascinating read. If you've ever been any kind of a comic fan, particularly if you were ever kind of a Marvel fan, but really anybody that, you know, was reading, you know, comics from the majors at any point in their life is going to find something interesting here, because it covers the whole history from, you know, its very beginnings of, you know, the stuff that was being published as Timely Comics in the 1930s, and then all the way up to, you know, around the time where you're starting to get the major films coming out with, you know, the Avengers films coming out.
I will have to put that on my list then.
Well, you know, and it's interesting about the protecting the brand that is the Fantastic Four. It's like, well, where's that care? The last movie that just came out. I mean, it doesn't seem. I know that money is always the bottom line factor. But again, with Stan Lee, you would think that he would, you know, give his heart and soul for his first family, because he, you know, this is the first. You know, I would think Marvel's first family. So it's interesting how we've got this history of these comic book movies, and Fantastic Four has never been a successful franchise. So it is interesting how it started off on a big crash. And, you know, I would imagine if Stan Lee had to know something about Roger Corman, I mean, anybody who's followed him knows that you see his name associated to a AAA title like Fantastic Four. It's like, what's wrong with this picture? Because typically he would not be associated with that. So again, my comment about the Stan Lee was that, If what they were saying was true, how he was on set and, you know, buying them donuts and just being kind of buddy-buddy with all the while having a different, you know, agenda all along, you know, that's kind of uncool. But again, it's Hollywood's never been cool anyway. I mean, it's like either kill or be killed. And I guess that's what, I mean, Stanley moved out to California to help, you know, grow the branding that went on, I believe, in the 80s. So, you know, this goes part and parcel to that, I guess. You know, you don't want to let any Tom, Dick, or Harry in ruin your branding. But yeah. Again,
it goes hand in hand in exactly what you were saying is, you know, that is the one. It's not the documentary's fault, but it is the, you know, kind of the weakness of the documentary is there is a whole other story that you wish you could be told, you know, a whole other side of what happened that you wish you could hear.
Yeah, the for me it was more about seeing how it seemed like people like Avi Arad and Stan Lee and other people at Marvel and other people at Fox were surprised that this movie was still going ahead. They're like, wait a minute, I thought that died on the vine. They're still making that? What the hell? We have to nip this in the bud. You don't send a cease and desist order unless you've been blindsided. And just the fact that absolutely nobody on the executive side, I guess, is willing to even make a comment.
Yeah, right.
None well, even, at even, all.
Even in the documentary, you know, it just seemed like with everyone that's part of this project, Roger Corman, he seemed to kind of, he looked like a man who was paid in this. So he was kind of briefly in the movie, but he almost felt like he was part to blame for all this because he was just having, you know, I know he lent his services and his studio and such for the making of this movie, but something tells me he was kind of making deals with the devil along the way as well.
Well, because you heard at the beginning that Corman put up $1 million or put up half of the million, and then Constantine put up half of the million. But then later you hear that Corman got $1 million for dropping the project, or what was it for dropping the project, or for, you know, just that was his slice of the pie for Fox and Marvel to absorb the project, to cut him out of the project while Constantine went ahead with it with Fox and Marvel. So
I think that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what it was. He, you know, he paid $500,000. He got $1 million back.
Well, you know, and if there's one person in the movie or in the documentary that I just felt extremely sad for was, you know, the, because, you know, this whole film was a passion project that by the time it got to the level it was. But Ole Sassoon, the director.
Yeah.
I really felt like he sacrificed everything. I mean, including, I don't know about his career, but I kind of went back and looked at what he's done. And, you know, it's not this impressive body of work you would expect. But I just wonder how much, if anything, did that hurt his you know, career in the business.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was interesting to see how much, you know, love he put into making it. I mean, at that point, it was almost when you have everything working against you, you know, not many people would probably persevere through that. And so, if anything, that's kind of what I was, my takeaway from the documentary was that, you know, he's obviously has a high tolerance for bullshit because I don't think many people would have been able to stand up to big companies like that and still go forward and finish the movie. So that was kind of cool. And again, what it did show me was that how you have people that were looking at this movie as a kind of a project that would, you know, propel their careers.
Yeah.
And incidentally, it's not what happened. And so I kind of felt sorry for some of these, you know, actors that were in this film because, you know, here we are now and none of them are household names. So.
Yeah. The one thing that I remember was how passionate all of the actors were when they were talking about putting up their own money to go to these conventions and to screen the trailer and to sign all these pictures and all the stills and the posters and just old school grassroots word of mouth, getting word of mouth to raise the interest in this thing. And that led to a special preview screening which caused everybody else at Fox and Marvel to plot and go, whoa, wait a minute. But they were, I mean, they were putting out money of their own pocket to travel to conventions, to sit there and say, you know, they didn't get any signing fees back then because people, not even top level people, were making a lot of money signing at conventions back then. That didn't happen until probably about 10 years later.
You know, but this, back in that time, we didn't have information readily available to you. So I imagine being a comic fan at the time, them seeing that, wait a minute, we've got some serious movement here. not knowing the backstory, there was probably lots of excitement generated. You know, would that happen in today's environment? Hell no.
No.
But then again, you also have crowdfunding going on and everything else. But I don't know. It's for me, and again, I know I think feels the same, is it would be great and all these nice factoids and stories if the movie itself was good. But it's and that's why it's kind of almost like, okay, we're really talking like romantically about this project. But then there's, I don't know. It's like you think any of those guys would look back and just look at the movie and say, you know what, this is really not very good. And just face the reality of it, you know, other than it's like a kind of like a yearbook of that time of their life. So I don't know. I appreciate their passion, but I just don't think the movie's very good, the actual movie itself.
Right. Well, in fact, actually, I think something to be aware of is Darren watched the documentary Doomed, and it got his interest up so much. He's like, huh, boy, maybe I ought to go revisit that 1994 Fantastic Four film. Maybe now, there is something I really overlooked.
Did you have a copy of it already? Did you have to go find one?
I got a copy from Noah, as a matter of fact. I do have a copy on VHS that I had mentioned in a review, but you know, that's VHS, and I'm not going to try to, you know, bring out the old player. And so, like I said, Noah had just given this to me like a year ago or so. So yeah, I fired it up because I generally was you know, now excited because now I had perspective on the actual movie. So naturally I was thinking, oh, well, maybe it's going to be better than what I remembered it. And of course, about 20 minutes into this thing, I'm going, okay, yeah. If it looks like a duck, acts like a duck, then by golly, it's a duck.
I think most of the people, most of the cast of that movie had a feeling that they were just doing the best they could. Because the one, what was it? I think it was the guy, Robert Culp.
Oh, yeah, was Dr. Doom.
Yeah, the Dr. Doom guy. He said he's watching them film one of the end scenes where, you know, Reed and Susan are getting married and driving away in the limo, and you see this spaghetti arm reach up out of the window. And he's like, maybe this isn't as good a thing as I think it is. So he was pretty honest in that moment.
Right.
You know what, though? And what is sad, though, is that of all the movies that we've seen for the Fantastic Four, I will agree, though, that this one at least hits the right notes spiritually. I mean, it does get that part right. But, you know, interestingly, Noah and I had this conversation a while ago, and remember you said this, maybe it's never going to work on the big screen. It's because you see this man stretching around. It's almost like Plastic Man, where it's almost kind of funny. It you really can't make it look serious when you see a guy stretch his arms, you know, 50 yards. And I don't know. Is it never going to represent itself on the big screen the way we see the Avengers and everything else? Is it just not possible?
I was going to say, yeah, that's a very interesting question. But I think so far what we've seen has been the two extremes where, you know, you had the Fox films that just went too far in making it goofy and slapstick kind of comedy. And then you had the recent Fox film, which among its other problems was taking itself far too seriously.
And I think part of the problem is a lot of the people, they look at it as Fantastic Four first without really understanding the history of the Fantastic Four, because the original Fantastic Four was all about the dynamic of family, because these people considered themselves friends and family before they went on that space mission that turned them all into superpowered beings. And I think all of the movies have missed that.
Oh, absolutely. You know?
I thought they had a chance. I mean, because it might have been the first movie or the second one, but there was an attempt at some actually very funny brother-sister banter between Chris Evans and Jessica Alba, and I think it kind of halfway fell flat, but at least they tried, you know? Because anybody who's got that annoying little brother, hello me, knows that there is a bit of sarcasm, a lot of snark, but at the end of the day, there you care, you know, because that's your brother, that's your sister. And right. I think the real family dynamic was missed. And from what you guys described of the first movie, it seemed to be closer in tone to the original comic books. And that to me says, well, it captured the family dynamic better. And if you want to look at a good superhero family thing, strangely enough, another series, a TV series starring Michael Chiklis, No Ordinary Family. I think they started to get that right. That was just, you know, the show just didn't have enough legs to get past one season.
You know, interestingly is that I think that's subconsciously why people have always been drawn to Fantastic Four, because there's a little bit of reminder of the relationship that kind of is you can relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why that comic book and that for decades has always been really fairly popular. And every time I hear they're going to make, three now before this one, after this one rather, I was excited every time I heard them, you know, release that there's making a new Fox is making a new Fantastic Four. It was always this hope, but then I always thought, oh, wait a minute, it's Fox. So that right away just killed my hope, because again, you know, I'm not going to say a whole movie company or production or is going to be responsible for making a bad superhero film. I mean, they do good work with the X-Men, so I don't know. But I just don't know that they're putting the right people in place to make the movie. You know, I don't know. It's one of those great mysteries.
I had hope for this newest Fantastic Four because they pulled in people from Marvel to help them get it right, and they still missed. I was like, what happened here?
Yeah, I don't know.
Who from Marvel came in on the new Fantastic Four?
I don't know. That was supposed to be... I thought that was what was supposed to be happening because Sony relented and did the crossover with Marvel and I'm drawing a blank on his name. Underoos. Spider-Man. Thank you.
Yes.
Just the fact that Sony relented and said, yeah, you can put Spider-Man in your movie. I was like, oh my. And I thought the whole thing with the whole controversy about Josh Trank not having the movie that he had initially wanted to make was because they brought in Marvel people to try to fix what he had made because it was so off the mark of what they expected. Now, is that, that's how I'm remembering it. Is that what really happened?
I think what really happened is probably not going to come out for,
I'll be damned too. Doing two. But you know what though? It was kind of a fun game with Noah and myself on a weekly basis. We would see like little news releases about Trank and his circus of misfits making the movie, and it was interesting that the play by plays you were hearing is that he was really over his head mm-hmm. making this film. He was kind of an asshole to all the crew.
I kept seeing that too.
And you take everything with a grain of salt, but. But again, I wasn't happy with what he did. He was changing the source material. And again, I'm an old-fashioned person when it comes to source material. So I wasn't exactly thrilled with what he was trying to do. But at the same time, if he was going to pull it off in a way that was going to be good, then fine. I can go with the flow. But from the moment the movie started, whether it was just he doesn't know how to really direct people or he had too many people meddling with it, for the first 20 minutes of the movie, it at least has it's watchable, but oh my God, the only thing I remember from that movie is listening to Noah like laugh his ass off. I mean, he was laughing and I was just pissed off because I was just thinking, I can't believe how bad this movie is. Because in my lifetime, I want to see one good Fantastic Four movie, just one. And I don't want to see the thing walk around without shorts, for God's sakes. That's just disturbing. Yeah.
All I could think while I was sitting there watching it is, wow, what's Riftrax going to say to this thing?
Oh,
that's I can't believe Riftrax hasn't gotten around to it yet.
I don't think they would actually get the rights to do it. That's part of the problem. They actually have to get the clearances and the rights to riff that movie. And I could see Fox very easily saying, oh, hell no.
But
you
I
think
mean,
it
they,
would think it's.
But they made it, they managed to riff the Avengers. They managed to riff.
They did.
Lord of the Rings. They managed.
Well,
yeah,
they mentioned
Peter Jackson's Return of the King.
I know.
Those were all successful.
Well, no, they also Starship Troopers. They riffed Starship Troopers, but they only had it for a limited time. I don't think you can buy that anymore from them. I could be wrong. I could be wrong,
well,
but yeah.
I just say with. Because my understanding is like with the downloads, because what it is you're just downloading an audio commentary that you play to the movie, so they don't need rights to the actual film. They're just doing a parody essentially.
But
so
some of the stuff they do have with they have the DVD of the film with the commentary on it.
Ah, right. Yeah, no, obviously that they're not going to get the rights to, that's for sure. Yeah.
Interesting. I would caution people who see Doomed, if their interest is piqued, like Darren was, you have had fair warning that the original 1993 or 94? 94. Fantastic Four Endeavor. It may not meet your standards. I believe the comment Darren made was something of, it's not even up to the level of a sci-fi Saturday monster movie.
That's about right. You know what though? Not to harp on this, but the quality of the copies that everyone has been exposed to is, as he had alluded to in the movie, was made by under the radar copy off of a copy. So it's like we're dealing with something that's so many generations down. I would, not that I'm not, it's going to make the film better, but I think it would at least, I would appreciate it more if I can see the film in its,
a cleaner state.
A cleaner state visually, and maybe the things would even show for a little better. And I'm not saying that would, again, that make the movie better, but at least I would, have to keep on bitching about that, I guess.
Yeah, I do have to say it is sort of ironic that so much energy was put into trying to bury this film, but then the major studio films really aren't any huge improvement.
They just have a bigger budget for special effects. The story definitely sounds like it was lacking on all fronts.
You think they would win the hearts, at least from a point of marketing? If Fox says, you know what, we recognize what we've done or haven't done, and we also recognize that this 1994 Fantastic Four has its own following, and basically release it on Blu-ray or something. I wonder how people would respond to that. I imagine it would be kind of positive, because where else can they go besides up?
True.
It would be acknowledging that, we've got to finally give these guys their just due or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's been long enough. I mean, it took them 20 years to release all the different versions of Blade Runner officially.
Oh, right. Yeah, but that movie's good though.
And
I alluded to in our review. I kind of likened this to in music terms. There's Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. He had made this record back in 68 called Smile. And upon showing the Beach Boys when they got back from touring, because Brian Wilson at that time wasn't touring, they thought, oh, this doesn't sound like us. This sounds rubbish. And so basically it put Brian into a deeper hole, and he basically destroyed the tapes. So for the next 30 years, you would hear these, bootlegs of what the record would have sounded like. And as a fan, I was just thinking, oh, my God, if only I could ever hear it. Well, they finally came out with it, at least with the best copies they could, about 3 years ago, and I was blown away. It was awesome. Well, again, comparing to this, if you have that same passion for something and all you would think about is how great it was or from fans talking, and then when you finally see it, what a letdown, man. And that's kind of what I was trying to say. It's like, this would be really, really fun and impassioned, and I would love to tell people about it if the movie itself was really good. But it's not. And I feel guilty for ripping on it like this, because some people like it, though.
If anyone in the hierarchy ever thinks that maybe there would be enough return on investment for releasing this on home video, it'll happen.
Yeah, I was actually of the impression that it was happening. Maybe I'm just making it up off the top of my head, but
I didn't get the impression from anything that was mentioned to that effect in the documentary, but if it is happening, hey, more power to it. The movie probably would have benefited from an underground internet fan base, but if I have my timing right, this all happened probably a month or two before the existence of the HTTP protocol, which happened in the middle of 94, but websites really didn't take off until probably in the fall of 94.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So they missed that boat. And just on a personal note, I was watching this documentary and they showed the special effects house who was making the animatronics for The Thing. And I saw John Vulich in the film. And I had just found out like 5 minutes before starting to watch this documentary that he died the night before.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was only 55. And he was like a special effects guru, and I know him because he did the effects on Babylon 5. I actually interviewed him.
Hmm.
And wow, I was like, that's... oh my God. I mean, the timing of that just blew me away. I was like, oh my God, really?
What did he die of, I may ask?
They don't know yet.
Huh.
They don't know yet? And it was how long ago?
Yesterday.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Well, jeez.
So I just was like, oh my God, John Vulich is in there. Wait a minute, what? Oh shit, he's dead.
Well, you know, since we're talking about Doomed and kind of showing the special effects, it was interesting how they specifically mentioned the company they hired, and I don't remember the name of the person that was going to be doing the special effects for the movie.
They actually did not mention the name of the company or the name of the individual because of...
Right, but it's interesting. I'd like to know who it was, though, because basically they said did not deliver what they were promised.
I believe the term he used was, we didn't realize at the time that the guy was really over his head.
Yeah. Well, and whoever they hired after that, I don't know. If I know their budget was an issue, but I remember watching movies in the early 90s with, you know, with graphics and CGI. I mean, I realized it was early days of grass, you know, grass at the beginning, but I remember seeing things look a lot better than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that if you're really on a shoestring budget, you're not going to get, but still I maybe if it had better visuals, that way it would be a little better. I don't know, man. I'm trying to find some good here.
I'm totally on board with you because there were some shows on there that had pretty good effects. Like I said, I mean, Babylon 5 hit TV in 93, and then the original pilot was in 93. The movie, the series started in 94. That had some pretty amazing graphics for the time. Those were done on Amigas. And the fact that guy that they hired couldn't do basic animation in what was considered acceptable Hollywood turnaround time blows me away.
Well, they were using those silicon graphic workstations back in those days, and just to buy those machines, you had to have lots of money. So again, I can see why they would have used a smaller company that could do that. But still, I mean, that stuff looks like it was done by some college kid who was making his weekend project. I mean, they're really that bad. The thing, for example, the thing was his parts were not that bad, you know, considering what they were dealing with. So, you know, considering...
You mean the way, like the way his face moved and stuff?
Well, that was all robotic. That was all robotics under the headpiece.
Right.
That wasn't...
But he's pretty much sucked in all the movies, though. I mean, it's amazing how they can never get the thing right.
Yeah.
He's a rock, for God's sakes. Come on. Maybe Peter Jackson should direct the Fantastic Four.
I don't know. You think they could afford him?
I think Fox is desperate enough that they would, because you know they have a valuable asset on their hands. That's a highly, people know who the Fantastic Four is. So why wouldn't they spend money on it? I mean, they spent it on this last one, which was just god awful.
Okay, here's a premise for you. Would you try to convince Fox to bring J.J. Abrams over to Fantastic Four to fix it?
No.
Why J.J. Abrams?
He's rebooted everything else.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that shoe fits his feet. I don't look at J.J. Abrams as a storyteller in the traditional sense, like a comic book style. I mean, he's kind of a flashy.
Well, look at what he's done. I mean, he doesn't do a lot of the work himself anymore. He brings in people he knows can do the job well.
Well, exactly. That's also being smart, but I don't know. I don't want it to be all green screen either. I guess I could draw the line. I want it to be a little organic in some ways too, because it's more about the storytelling, like you said, and we don't need to have another movie. Because, if you look at all the last couple of movies they've made, there was lots of graphics in it, obviously. And so, I don't know. There's a fine line balance that you need. And just to bring somebody in who can actually tell a story from the beginning. And I don't know. I like J.J. Abrams' work. I'm just not the hugest fan of his, per se.
All right. Would you rather have some of the people who are responsible for the Netflix Marvel shows try their hand at Fantastic Four?
Who I could see doing an interesting job with Fantastic Four would be James Gunn if he wasn't doing Guardians of the Galaxy.
Interesting.
That's a good choice. There's got to be a comedy element to it. And like you said, the brother-sister dynamic has to really work. Chris Evans, actually, I liked his role in Human Torch. I thought he did a great job.
He brought the right amount of devil may care and humor and intensity to what Johnny Storm is. Because Johnny Storm is a reckless kid. He's young, and oh my God, I can put myself, set myself on fire. He has two reasons to be a rock star, and he's going to take advantage of it.
Exactly. And Sue Storm is like big sister looking out for him, and there's always that dynamic between the two of them. And I don't know. I think that would be kind of natural on the big screen, something we could all connect to. But what director could actually do that? I don't know. That's.
And now that I think about it, I think a Fantastic Four arc as a 12 or 13 episode Netflix series might be able to tell the story better.
Well, I think in all formats that it's always better anyway, because that's the problem with the format of telling these movies on the big screen. You've only got a window to do that. And with one thing we've seen, at least I've seen from Netflix, is that you've got a series of shows you can run to, kind of build and develop a character. So your arc feels more natural. And now you also can tell a story and I don't know, and not overwhelm the audience with nothing but just explosions and fight scenes and everything. So I think it's definitely something that develops
and
more naturally.
The reason that came to my mind is we've had how many Punisher movies? 3? And now we're moving Punisher to Netflix.
It's going to be good.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to that one.
I think Punisher and who he is and what he is perfect for Netflix.
Yeah,
right.
I am a little concerned, though. I mean, again, Noah and I have also talked about this recently about the Netflix, the sense that there's a dark tone in all so what I've seen so far. And again, I haven't watched Luke Cage yet, but from the
there's a very, very dark edge in Luke Cage.
Well, and but if I recall, in the comic books, there was also a little humor to it as well. I know that there was a reflective, a reflective story.
There's humor in it too. But I mean, I like how, because Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage have this dark, they are in the middle of the dark, seedy underbelly of the city that never sleeps. You've got this bright, shiny city, but there's the seething cesspool of crime and corruption underneath of it. And these are what these characters are fighting. They're the second tier guys. And they mentioned it. It's like, hey, you know, you want to take your anger out on somebody, go talk to the green guy or the guy with the shield, you know, and Jessica Jones.
Well, you know, and again, I could totally see that too. And in the beginning, I totally loved it with the Daredevil, but I don't know. And again, I'm not saying we should run away from that. I do embrace that because it's real and it's kind of more, but I don't mind it being a superhero vibe either, you know, because why can't you wear the costume?
Right. I mean, for me, the thing is, I'm okay with that for a while, but after I'm like, you know, 40, 50 episodes into all this stuff, it's like, okay, come on, guys. Can't you do anything else than just give me, you know, this like constant, dark, harsh, depressing, grim reality?
People want what Frank Miller gave them.
Yeah, but I know it's like listening to minor chords all day. And sometimes I like to hear a major chord, you know, something right. Bright and clean, you know. And I'm going to be honest with you, the one thing that bothered me about the Daredevil, and I loved both seasons all, I just don't know why. I hated the fact that how much of a dick Matt Murdock was to Foggy, and it just bothers me to this day. Yep. And again, I read comic books, I read Daredevil religiously, and I just don't remember that dynamic being that obvious. Again, that could be that's many years of, you know, cobwebs in there. But I didn't like that feeling. And it kind of goes back to that bond. You know, you're in this dark cesspool and all these things working against you. And I would think that you would want the closest people to stick together because of that. And maybe we'll get that the next season. I don't know. But he was just a total douche, you know, to him. Mm-hmm. And it just bothered me how they closed that out.
Yeah. And that.
And to Karen, too.
Yeah. And yeah. Wilson Fisk is supposed to be back in season 3, right?
Yeah, and since when did Kingpin cry? Jesus. I mean, come on. I get humanizing the man, but he never cried in the comic books. He was crying like a little baby in the, you know, and again, it's all about reality, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I want something that'll never happen.
Well, he can't be 110% evil because then you never You're always rooting for Daredevil to punch him in the face or, you know, break his arm, you know?
And I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, pissing on the whole thing. I feel so fortunate and, you know, in my lifetime to actually experience something like this because, you know, growing up, what did we always wish, you know, there was going to be, you know, our comic book heroes, you know, represented correctly, you know?
We wanted to see them on the big screen, so.
Yeah. And so I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth, but like I said, it's just, okay, let's have a little fun with it too.
Well, I tell you what, we will put a pin in this discussion. People go check out the documentary Doomed because it is a lot of fun and very enlightening and possibly sobering for anyone considering moving into the Hollywood industry as a creative. And I think we need to have Darren go see Luke Cage, and then we have to wait until after Doctor Strange comes out, and then we can have a complete total Marvel talk. What do you think?
There you go.
Absolutely.
All right. That'll do it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to call in. The number is 602-635-6976. Leave a voicemail message, ask a question. We're here for you. We geek, you geek, we all geek. Let's have some fun with it. You can also email your questions to summer@sliceofsci-fi.com. You can also email your recorded comments if you want. You can listen to the show through iTunes, through Stitcher, through TuneIn, and Krypton Radio. And if you do listen on iTunes or on Stitcher, leave us a review. Give us a rating. Let other people know that you enjoy the show and maybe they should check it out too. You can check us out on Twitter @SliceOfSciFi, @SliceOfSciFiTV. We're also on Google+, Slice of Sci-Fi, and on YouTube, Slice of Sci-Fi there as well. And as always, we have the websites, sliceofscifi.com, We also have popculturegeeks.com, kickassmysticninjas.com, and writersafterdark.com for all of your storytelling needs. If you're curious about book reviews, if you're curious about what makes a storyteller want to be a storyteller, we might have a couple of interviews that can help answer that question for you. Thank you, everyone, for your support through Patreon, patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. All of your pledges do go to support the websites and the media for the shows here. Same for Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas and the other shows that we have archives of out there. And if you want to help support what we're doing here too, head on over, patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. I'd also like to put out a big thanks to Sci-Fried, my favorite geek rock band, for the music that adorns the show here. If you want to check out more by them, they're at sci-fried.com. But that'll do it. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.